In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Little Stephen's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's coolest conversations time at Little Stephen's Underground Garage, presented by Hard Rock. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. 2026 is the 50-year anniversary of Graham Parker's debut album, Howlin' Wind. It's also the subject of the recent book, Graham Parker's Howlin' Wind by Jay Nachman. The noted English singer-songwriter seemingly burst on the UK music scene in 1976, backed by The Rumour. Now, they had their roots in pub rock, but as you'll hear, Graham does not. He'll also tell us some about his early days, songs off the album, and its recording. First, though, we'll hear some of the tune Soul Shoes from Howlin' Wind, and then I'll be back with Graham Parker, for your coolest conversations presented by Hard Rock in Little Stephen's Underground Garage. Mighty Manfred with you in Little Stephen's Underground Garage, and we've got a very special Coolest Conversations lined up for you today with musician and songwriter Graham Parker. This year he's celebrating the 50-year anniversary of his debut album, Howlin' Wind, and the album and its release are the subject of the book, Graham Parker's Howlin' Wind by Jay Nachman. Hey Graham, how are you?
Hi Mighty Manfred, I'm okay, thank you very much. How are you, okay?
Yes, I am, and very, very, very excited to be chatting with you today. Jay's book about your album, Howlin' Wind, in there, he's talking about your early days and getting together with Rumour and recording the debut album. And I thought it was interesting that when you grew up there in the UK, down the street, very close to an American Army base, and your mother used to work there occasionally, and then sometimes troops get transferred out, and they would leave their records behind, and how one time she brought a bunch of Little Richard records home for you to listen to. Now, were these the first rock and roll records you owned? And if not, what was the first rock and roll record you owned?
Yeah, that's right. She worked occasionally a few times every year at the officers' mess, as it was known, where the officers gathered and they had tea and snacks and sometimes little parties in the evening. And they were always being shifted around because, you know, it was still post-war army, different bases, Germany, Malta and Aden and all this kind of stuff. So they'd often get moved off. And I think somehow one of them or a few, what is your son like? You know, she talked about me, a little kid, you know. He likes music and matchbox tops. I collected matchbox tops you know. And the, I tell you, the exotic matchbooks that came back from probably not very savory clubs in the Orient, you know, from Japan or Thailand, I don't know where they were from. These match, these little matchbooks you got. There were actual boxes sometimes, but often little matchbooks. They had wax matches in them. I've still got some of those in boxes in upstate New York in a lockup. It's crazy. I don't know how why I took all these matchbooks over there just to sit in boxes. But there was that, and then there was the music as well. And there was a quite a stack of Little Richard records, singles. You know, and you put those little funny, they were off jukeboxes. You put those little funny things, the squiggly things in the middle, you know, those little plastic right. things, so you could play them. And there were other, there were some vinyl albums as well. There's James Brown record, a Carl Denver record. What else? Oh, there was amazing. I think it was an Ike and Tina Turner record as well at some point. Now I'm remembering. Nutbush City Limits, was that right? That may
that would have been much. That would have been much later. Yeah,
much later. No, okay. I just bought that probably, or just somebody handed it down to me. The army officers that gave the records, but the Little Richard bunch were in there, and yeah, I'd never heard anything quite like it. It was tremendously exciting. I think it was pre the Beatles that I heard it. Whenever those singles out, some of them might have been out in the '50s, right?
Yeah, yeah, those would have been, those all would have been late '50s,
and one of them had Kansas City on, his version of Kansas City, and which me and the Rumor used to play. I got them.
Wow.
Yeah, we used to play it on our very early tours, very early gigs, and of course we did it in actual Kansas City, our first time there. And it seemed to go right over everyone's heads, which was weird. But yeah, it was. But yeah, we did it a few times. It was fun, kind of an encore, you know.
Well, you know, it's funny. I was going to say over here, there's this for musicians of a certain era, a certain age. In fact, even up going as recent as like REM's Peter Buck, he has the same story about. Turning on the TV in the U.S. and seeing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, and how, you know, that was the epiphany for this, for a certain era of musicians. I hear it all the time. They all saw that performance, and the Beatles certainly resonated with you there in the U.K. My understanding from the book is that after the release of Love Me Do in 1962, you were forming your first band with friends and schoolmates, the Black Rockers.
Yeah. Well, we were the Deep Cut Three. That was kind of the name of the village. And it was then called Blackdown, actually, Blackdown Army Camp, which it morphed into Deep Cut. In fact, I grew up, I was born in London, but only 4 years there. And then grew up in the county of Surrey, which is not far from London, really, 35, 40 miles in that area. And it used to be, my address used to actually be Blackdown near Aldershot, which Aldershot is the town 10 miles away from where I grew up, really, in the village that I grew up, which was known as the home of the British Army. And one day I woke up and I was in Deep Cut near Camberley, Surrey. So it was kind of, I think it's some early conservative gerrymandering so they could get even more votes.
Right.
Yeah, it was something like that. They shifted the borders, you know, to keep the hoi polloi out or something, you know. My dad would have never voted conservative anyway. He was like total working class, and he voted for what he thought supported him, the Labour Party. But they never got anywhere in Surrey. It was always the Conservatives, always, probably still is. A lot of money there. So being working class, it was a pretty chill place to grow up, because it was the country, and you know, it wasn't like the industrial north. But yeah, we got the Beatles came along, and that changed everything, because it was the look and the excitement of a band that came from Liverpool and the Rolling Stones from basically 30 miles up the road in London.
Yeah.
And all the other beat groups, they were sort of so familiar in a way, because they looked like your older cousin or something. Well, they didn't look, your older cousin had a quiff like the, you know, Cookie in 77 Sunset Strip, one of our favorite shows. So we had the American culture all going on, and then suddenly we had our own bands that were so close to us in a way. Mm-hmm. They would, you know, when you saw that McCartney could do a pretty good Little Richard job, what did they do? What did he sing? One of their early singles was a Little Richard tune. Good Golly Miss Molly, was it? And I know they did Roll Over Beethoven,
right,
Chuck
right.
Berry. So there was all that mix-up of stuff, and you started to learn about where it all came from, and there I was with these Little Richard records. It's like, oh, okay, this is what they're influenced by, this stuff I've been listening to on my little turntable there. And so the band I had, that was the Deep Cut Three, and then we added a member and became the Black Rockers.
But now at that point, you guys weren't actually playing your instruments, so right? You were quite young. You hadn't actually learned how to play?
No, I never really took that bit seriously, nor did the other kids. It was the look and a photograph. The photograph appears in the book of the Black Rockers with the... I don't know how we got hold of tight black jeans. I've no idea. At the age of 12, 13, one of the kids might have been 11, the drummer or something. I mean, it was incredible. And black shoes. I said, everybody's got to get these black Cuban heels and black jeans and a black polo neck sweater, what we called a polo neck or a polar neck. And we found all this stuff. Our parents obviously helped us and bought this stuff for us and paid for a photographer to take a photo by a brick wall, of course, that looked pretty radical, you know. But we didn't learn the playing part. That would seem to be irrelevant, really.
Not if the girls were all hip to you guys looking good, I guess that was enough at the time.
Well, it worked. We played my friend Paul, the blonde, sort of platinum blonde kid with the two guitars. There's me on one on the left side of the photo as you look at it, him on the right. His dad owned a gas station, a petrol station, and there was all these buildings attached to it that were deserted, empty. That was part of his property. And in the middle of the buildings, these empty, disused buildings, was the bay where they fixed the cars, and the oil ran down the drains. It just went into the, I don't know where it went, probably came out into the rivers or something. I have no idea. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know where it went, but I never saw it in any of the local waterways. So maybe it went somewhere safer. We just used one of these abandoned houses, which was next to Paul's actual parents' home. And his sister would take money, threepenny bits, you know, which was about 2 cents or something. For kids, the local kids came, little kids, all about 10 years old, 11, 12. And we'd sort of run down the stairs, jump on a table, turn around and do some horrific version of a Beatles song. What a noise. And they screamed, because that's what you saw on TV when you were lucky enough to see those of us who had TV sets, you know.
Yeah.
it was exciting. We made these money. Stupid. But we didn't do the, you know, we didn't take the actual step of really learn. I was fiddling around on the guitar, trying. I was trying. And I wrote a couple of songs pretty quickly with the limited, you know, after the band had more or less finished, I started to find a couple of chords. There was definitely something going on there, and learn a few bits and pieces. In fact, to my friend Paul, I played him this song I'd written, and it was a total ripoff of Hoochie Coochie Man, which was a B-side, which was an old, you know, it's an old R&B song. Again, a white band, I think it was Dave Berry and the Cruisers, and I somehow got that single, and it was a B-side of that. I think he did Hoochie Coochie Man, if my memory's right there. So I pretended I'd written it. He said, "That's Hoochie Coochie Man." I said, "Okay. Yeah, guilty as charged." But I wrote another song called Won't You Come Back, which was original, but it had all the whoop, the Beatles things in it. You know, it had all those bits going on. So I was even creative then. It was always there, but I just didn't knuckle down until I'd gone through sort of every single fashion craze that I could go through. You know, this.
Well, let me talk. Let me ask you about one of these things too. In fact, I'm familiar with the notion of mods and rockers, but in the book, though, it describes you as being a moddie. So is a moddie different from being a mod?
Well, it was a bit after the mod stage. I definitely had in school, I had that haircut where you backcombed it and it stuck out a bit, like fuzzy, like Ron Wood has his hair today sticking out. Rod Stewart had that sort of look, a bit of a bouffant with it sticking out the back. And I had some sort of op art pants, trousers that a girl, sort of girlfriend named Beth actually made for me out of some awful vinyl-y material. We were on this pretty quickly, you know, we were just kids there. But when I was about 15 or 16, the mod thing had moved away, but the follow-up was like a skinhead look, which was really short hair. And at least in that part of Surrey, Woking, we called up ourselves Moddy Boys.
Okay.
And the other people were the Greasers, the Rockers. We're now called the Greasers. They were the motorbike fiends, and we wanted the Lambrettas and the Vespas. And soon I got, when I was about 16, I got my first Lambretta SX150. And so, but the look was very, very much this shorn sort of hair. It was called, I remember it being called cropped for a while. It was like some kind of agricultural experiment, you know, cropped hair. Or, you know, crops, something like
that. Hopefully no crop circles were going on.
No, I don't think they were around then. It was basically what you call a crew cut in really, really short.
Well, during that, let me ask you, during that Moddy period, is that when you really developed this love of soul music? Or had you already been listening to, like, soul and R&B stuff prior to, like, you know, 15, 16?
Yeah, I think when I was 14, my cousin was moving, and again, I got a free gift of a couple of records. One of them from him was the Otis Redding Sing Soul.
Oh, yeah.
Which did have some cover versions on, which I didn't really know. I'd missed at the time. Sam Cooke, Change Is Gonna Come, Wonderful World, and Otis did Satisfaction, actually. So I think I was about 14 then. And Respect, there was that song that I believe he wrote that, and Aretha,
correct, yeah, that's
did
right.
That, yeah. So I had that record, which was tremendously influential to me, absolutely tremendous. I learned about Duck Dunn and Steve Cropper, you know, who I actually got the pleasure to work with on a tour in 1992 or 4, was it? Dave Edmunds' Rock and Roll Review, which featured Dion of Dion on the Belmonts, Kim Wilson from the Fabulous Thunderbirds, me, and Dave Edmunds. We were the head part of that, and we had the Miami Horns. We had these great, amazing players, Phil Chen on the bass, Steve Cropper on guitar. Hello. So that, and we toured America with that. And it was quite.
That was in the early 90s?
Yeah, man. Yeah. My record at the time was a record called Human Soul. There was a song on it called Soul Time, which kind of writes about some of my exploits as a moddy boy, getting my head butted somewhere, you know, in a club, and stuff like that, the usual stuff you go through as a youth. People think of the suburbs in England as like, oh, all genteel and middle class. It was the most violent place I've ever known. And I lived in Manhattan, you know, in just a bit before the 80s kicked in, actually in the 80s, early 80s. And English people would say to me, oh, is it dangerous? Is it scary there? I said, no, nothing's as scary as when they throw them out of the pubs on a Friday night in the suburbs of England. Nothing is as scary as that, I tell you what. So you grew up, you know, you had to learn a bit of how to defend yourself and stuff, but you did... Yeah, it was rough because not all the Moddy boys were nice. There was the skinhead part of it, you know.
Right, you were mentioning that. When you had talked a moment ago, you were talking about, I think you said cousin had lent you or given you like these like soul records, like Otis Redding. Is that the same guy that gave you a guitar? Is that how you got your first guitar? Was that from your cousin?
Oh, yeah. The first guitar that I hold in the photograph in the book, Graham Parker's Howling Wind, Jane Nachman's book there, that guitar I'm holding is the one my cousin gave me. It's sort of... I don't know what brand it was. Not much of a brand at all, but it was good enough to, you know, to learn to pluck out a few notes here and there. And so that was from my cousin. Everything was hand-me-down then, often. The books you got, the comics and all this kind of stuff, when they got too old for it, they gave it to you. So I got that guitar, which was... where that's gone, I don't know.
What about this red guitar? Am I remembering this correctly? That you used to play like on a red acoustic guitar?
Oh, that came later. That came in the psychedelic age.
Oh, okay.
That came when I was about 18. I'd moved early 1969. I was still me and a couple of other guys from the job we were doing. By then, I had long hair, but I wasn't. I wasn't really in the psychedelic period. I was a straight, as they call it, but I had long hair because I loved the blues bands. Peter Green was my idol. Peter Green's Fleetwood Mac. Chicken Shack. Unbelievable. And you could see all these acts around the suburbs. I mean, people like Freddie King played regularly around my area. Sonny Terry, Brown and McGee, I'd see them a few times. Before I was old enough to go in a pub, but you bluffed your way in, you know, and managed to get in, and your older friends bought you a pint, you know. It's amazing. The music in the suburbs was really something in the Surrey and Hampshire, wherever. There was probably lots up north as well, because a lot of those acts, black acts, couldn't get arrested in America. Nobody knew who they were. They came to Europe to make money, to do gigs. We revered these acts because of the connection as well with the Stones and the Beat Groups, the Yardbirds, hello, you know, there was all that. So everything kept going there, but that the red guitar I bought in the island of Guernsey, and there's two major islands, Jersey and Guernsey, and a lot of little islands, Sark and Herm, and they're between England and France, roughly. And they're very French, but English as well, sort of English, whatever you call it, part of the Commonwealth or something. And they're tax havens as well, you know. They're used as tax havens to some extent. But I was just there to do something different, to get out of England, because I
right. Were you originally went there to pick tomatoes?
Yeah, that was it, because one of the kids I knew, you know, we were 18 sort of thing and going on 19, and one of the kids had an uncle there, and he was in the landscaping business, the tomato business, and they had these beefsteak tomatoes. Guernsey was famous for it. That was their industry, and Jay writes about it. He researched all this background so well that I learned a lot of things from the book about my first album, which is always good to learn stuff, you know. And so that's what I did. For a short while, I did that job. Me and my friend Dave and Mick was the kid whose uncle it was who gave us the job. And we'd go up these ladders. They had trunks like small trees, and they were, you know, in greenhouses, massive, great plants, Jack and the Beanstalk height. And you started at the bottom pulling these giant tomatoes off, and then you had to go up the ladder with your basket. You got filthy. You breathed in probably DDT and every poisonous chemical known to man, which, you know, yeah. who knows what that did? As well as, you know, you lived in your parents' house and you picked at the paint and ate it, which was lead paint, you know, when you were a baby. This is how we grew up.
Yeah.
It was normal. We probably never were normal after that, which is why we all went into rock and roll. You know, that may have had a great deal to do with it.
I have had. Well, I was I was going to ask you some of the stuff about the album, but before I do that, you brought up an interesting thing here about, you know, describing working in the tomato picking industry. You've had an amazing run of just really different jobs. I mean, I know by the when you get signed, you're like working at a petrol station, but you had all kinds of worked, so odd factory jobs, and you worked, what was this place that was like, I think you had to, were you responsible for calling, having to call animals at this hoof and mouth facility?
Yeah, that was my first job that I found myself without any help from anyone. I was a nature freak, you know, I really was. Yeah. It was really part of my life growing up. David Attenborough to this day is still, you know, one of the greatest people on the planet Earth ever. I've watched everything that he's made practically and read books and stuff by him. And I found a job at this place called the Animal Virus Research Institute, which was basically, you know, I wasn't qualified. I was uneducated. I came from the sort of class system education part of England because my parents were working class. So you don't get the breaks, you know. So that's what you do. And I got the job. I thought, well, I'm not working in a petrol station, which is, I ended up working in a petrol station when my career began because it was convenient for me, you know, while I was writing songs. But right. At that point, I didn't want to do that. So I got this job and basically, yeah, you were breeding mice. So I was in that part. I wasn't in the research part because that's people with degrees. Right. You know, intelligent people, not idiots like me. So me and Dave and Mick worked in that bit. And at the same time, we'd had enough of it. It was pretty sickening. You were breeding animals for research to be killed.
Yeah.
And it got me, it sort of emotionally sickened me because I just did it because it was a job and it wasn't the usual jobs that the uneducated kids did. It was different, you know. So I stuck with it for a bit there and then went, you know, sort of by the time I got to 18, like probably a couple of years of it, you know, really, that's when we all resigned on the same day and left and then got on the ferry and went to Guernsey. And then, you know, after picking tomatoes, I worked in a bakery and did other jobs on the island and then came back to England and worked in factories, like working presses that you stamped out parts, machine parts on these presses. And the Chichester, I moved to Chichester in Sussex, stayed with my cousin and worked at the Chichester Rubber Glove Factory. There's a title for you. And the last job I had, the last menial job out of many was the petrol station. And I did that for convenience. It was around the corner from my parents, so I had somewhere free to stay. And all I was doing was writing songs. I was on a mission.
Your parents must have been, I mean, they seem to be very supportive. Even from going back to the time of the Black Rockers, right? They helped you get these outfits. And then you go to Guernsey, you come back, you stay with your folks. I mean, you go other places too, depending on what jobs you can get. But it seems like they were always there to support you to come back. And you could, you know, as you said, you could live at home, write songs. Were your parents, in the end, were they pretty happy with your success? How do they feel about you being a rock and roller? Did that always seem like, you know, this is nice, son, but it's time for you to settle down?
No, they just couldn't believe it, frankly, because suddenly I was on TV. And I was in the papers, you know, and there was all this quite a bit of a hubbub about me, really. And when we'd got to this stage where we were playing like the theater type rooms, I'd get a limo to pick my parents up and come, you know, in the suburbs there and come up and bring them up to London, where I was usually crashing around and they, you know, the neighbors were like, God, get those giant cars out of the way. What are you doing? Sure, showing off like that. Bloody great limousine. And they come up, and before one show, my dad came up on stage at the Hammersmith Odeon, which we would do like three nights at, you know, it was like 2,000 plus people a night, sold out. And so I'd bring them up there, and my dad walked on the stage as everybody's setting it up. There's people up, we're doing the lights, you know, monkey climbing around, and all these cables are coming out everywhere. And my dad said to me, "This is all for you, isn't it?" I said, "Oh, yeah, I suppose it is." And he was like, he couldn't believe it. And then they're in the audience, and the audience are going bonkers, you know, once we're playing. And it was full on by then. It was like 79 into 1980. And so they, I don't think they could have been any happier, really. They thought, because they never thought I'd go anywhere much. You know, they just indulged me because they liked music as well. They weren't aficionados. My dad couldn't tap his feet in time. My mum had a pretty voice. I hear her singing. But it was one of those things that, you know, we listened to the radio. They liked jazz. They liked, you know, they liked things. And the Beatles came. They kind of liked the Beatles. They liked the songs. They thought they were catchy. My dad would sing them and stuff, you know. So they were open to it all. And then suddenly they're seeing me doing this. They were astonished. And they were very proud. So, yeah, that'll do.
So thinking about Howlin' Wolf, the debut album, and, you know, Jay's writes
Howlin' Wind, be careful.
Howlin' Wind, excuse me. Yes,
I think there was a bit of the influence of the name Howlin' Wolf, definitely, right. In the title. Yeah. With that.
So in Jay's book, there's and with the song that's on the album, Between You and Me, it seems like, it's an early song that you've written, and you got a lot of mileage out of that in the sense that not it's on the album, of course, but also that was like a demo that you recorded a couple of different times.
Well, I recorded that pre The Rumor, before they existed,
right.
with Dave Robinson. I'd managed to infiltrate myself with a few people in London, finally, at the age of 24. And I'd come up from the petrol station in the afternoon,
yeah,
and meet a few people. And one of them, a great musician, Noel Brown, who's passed away, died quite some years back now. But he knew a few people who led me to Dave Robinson, this guy with this sort of little studio, 8-track studio. And it turned out David had a history in music. He'd taken photos of the Beatles at the Cavern Club. He was a photographer. By sort of accident, he'd ended up as Jimi Hendrix's roadie and sort of tour managed him to some extent in America. And then he'd managed these acts that I'd never heard of, really. And they turned out to be what's known as pub rock acts, which nobody I knew had ever heard the term. It was unknown outside of London and probably a few major cities. And I was in Morocco quite a lot of the time, so I missed some of their exploits that would have been in the Melody Maker paper, you know, the Music Rag or the New Musical Express, NME. So I missed the information about them, but I saw their names when I was, you know, getting close to a career, when I was getting writing good songs, in other words, like Between You and Me, I realized this is the best I've ever written. I am now not writing noodly psychedelic songs like I was when I bought that red guitar. Because it was all psychedelia that basically made me take music seriously. Strangely enough, ironically, it wasn't beat music. It wasn't anything with a 4-4 beat. It was, King Crimson. It was Pink Floyd. It was all that stuff and Steve Miliband and all these psychedelic things. I was tripping and things. It was all, that was what was going on in Guernsey, and then. But gradually I started to work my way away from that and found myself extremely excited when I heard Can't Hurry Love on the radio, like I heard it when I was 15 or 14. And suddenly I'm deeply excited about that again. And so I'm writing songs that are more like real songs, plus the influence of the 70s singer-songwriters. Along with the psychedelia, there was James Taylor appeared, you know, Joni Mitchell. You know, later on, Jackson Browne, and you realize, wait a minute, you didn't have to have a psychedelic band, you could write songs on an acoustic guitar and actually perform, maybe. So they were deeply influential. They kicked me. It was like a kick in the butt, really. Like, I'm in my 20s, man. Get going. George Harrison was 17 when he was with the Beatles. Yeah, I know. I thought I'd miss the boat, really. But then I started writing those songs, and Dave Robinson recognized straight away when somebody led me to Dave and said, "You've got to hear this guy." And Dave, I think the light bulb went on in his head. And he heard the songs and said, "Let's record that one. Let's record that." And he'd get backing musicians, some London guys, to do it for a pint, because the studio was above a pub. And we'd go downstairs, pour ourselves some free pints, and go out to the studio and record.
I think I should want to add here about Dave is that, as you mentioned, he's quite a character in the UK music history going from the late 60s forward. And my understanding is he also co-founded Stiff Records with money he got from getting you signed. Am I understanding that right?
Well, I think that he was my launch pad, basically. Okay. Dave was the launch pad for me because he had the connections and he knew this DJ, Charlie Gillette, who I'd never heard of, on a small radio station called London Radio, which I'd never heard of either, because you could barely pick it up outside of London, where my parents were. I think you could just about manage if you got your antenna in the right place, you know, got on the right hill or something. So Dave was really the launching pad for me, but he wasn't making money out of any other bands right then. There was because of the Brinsley Schwartz band, who he'd managed to split up. I think he helped Ian Drury out. He tried with him, Kilburn and the High Roads, who under Stiff Records became, the Blockheads, Ian Drury and the Blockheads. And
Ian Drury and the Blockheads, yeah.
Yeah, so none of those bands were doing anything. They sort of split up. They were playing pub gigs. They couldn't get past the pub gigs where people started out as, like the Rolling Stones played pubs. Yeah. Sort of, you know, everybody plays a bar in America before you make it. So it was that kind of equivalent. And Dave, I came along out of nowhere. I didn't have any of that pub rock baggage. You know, I was unknown. And when my song got played on radio, the demo of Between You and Me, which ended up being on Howling Wind, because me and the Rumour tried to record it, and I wasn't satisfied with it, nor was Nick Lowe, I don't think. Dave wasn't. So we put the demo on, and that was what got me the record deal. And the Rumour guys were playing together, but they weren't doing gigs. They were wondering what to do next.
Right, and Dave put the Rumour together, didn't he? He set those guys up with each other.
Well, he put them behind me. I don't know whether he put them together. They were doing stuff, but there was nothing serious. They needed a front man, frankly, and that turned out to be me, of all people, somebody from absolutely nowhere. But I think it worked out in a sense because I didn't have the pub rock baggage. Those guys had record deals with A&E Records, I think it was called, A&M. Before I knew about them in the like 71, I think, when I was in Morocco or somewhere, and when I was, you know, on the hippie trail, those guys did have records, but they didn't really break out because it was prog rock those days. Their music just wouldn't have fitted in. And I learned all this much later, you see. I finally heard a Brinsley Schwartz record that Brinsley gave me or Martin gave me. And I really didn't quite see the relevance of it, but, you know, somehow the words pub rock crept into the lingo in the press with me because of these five guys, you know, and three of them have been in the Brinsley Schwartz band, two of them.
Yeah, two of them, right.
And the producer.
Brinsley Schwartz and Bob Andrews.
Bob
right,
Andrews, the late Bob Andrews on keyboards. And they were in this backing band. I didn't know them from Adam, you know. And Dave, you know, after a few attempts at producers, we weren't sure what we wanted. Dave thought Nick Lowe, who it turns out also was in this band, Brinsley Schwartz.
Right. And let me make it clear that so you had not heard Brinsley Schwartz when you met Brinsley and Andrew and Nick Lowe. You weren't familiar with having heard Brinsley Schwartz prior to working with those guys.
No, that suddenly I'm rehearsing with these guys and eventually I'll get an album. And by then I'm in the press.
Right.
You know, and by then my records come out and suddenly I'm a bit of a thing, you know. People are scrambling to interview me and stuff, and I keep seeing this word, these words, pub rock. I'm like, okay, I've been hearing about these guys that are pub rock, and I'm playing with them. And I heard a Brinsley record and thought, what the heck? This has got nothing to do with me. It doesn't sound anything. At the time, I was so into being totally aggressive, like my vocal style, because I didn't know how to sing. It was, everything was by default, really.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't know how to sing. I'd never really performed seriously. I'd done bits and pieces, you know, played, you know, the singer-songwriter night, you know, get up on stage night at the folk club here and there. And, I knew I was getting pretty good. And what I knew was I'd written these songs and I wasn't hearing any artist at the time as good as this. That was what I thought in my head. Dave Robinson appeared to agree. And a guy from Phonogram agreed. He heard one song, Between You and Me, and called up and said, I want to sign that guy. So within a couple of weeks, Dave Robinson said, this guy from Phonogram called up. He wants to sign you. That's a major label. And by that time, I thought my songs were so good and nobody else was anywhere near it who was new. There was nothing. And I thought, even though it's not, it's not like ready for the, it's not the sort of chart music now. You got to, early 76, it was still progressive rock.
Yeah.
That ruled the, you know, album listening. That's what people listened to. But there was something in the music press about something called punk. There was that. And there was this history of something called pub rock. And I was nothing to do with any of this. But, you know, people have to label you. Otherwise, there's no reference. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I understand that. I understand the labeling. I thought I was just a singer-songwriter and an aggressive one at that. And there wasn't much of that aggression around because the prog rock was a bit more gentle, you know, for the most part. But then I found out there were people operating like that, I suppose. I mean, I'd heard Hawkwind. I suppose Lemmy was a bit of an aggressive singer, wasn't he? He's kind of revered in the punk world to some extent.
Oh, very much so. Motorhead, definitely. Very much.
Yeah,
so,
I wasn't that familiar, but I'd heard the Hawkwind stuff because it was part of the tripping stuff. That, you know, psychedelic sort of. It was part of that to an extent.
So Dave puts you together with the rumor, and you got these songs worked up, and you come to this. First practice, they have to kind of figure out what parts they're going to be playing. You know, you've got two guitar players. They're both Brinsley Schwartz and Martin Belmont, yourself on acoustic. Is there any song on the album or songs maybe that you thought were solid, but then after these guys contributed, you're like, oh, this is definitely a masterpiece. I mean, when you're working through arrangements with them, was there any song that you thought it was okay, but now it's brilliant?
I thought they were all good. I thought every single song was good enough. And I thought they were deserving of the treatment by these quality musicians. The thing is about these guys, they played for so long. Brinsley Schwartz Band, Nick Lowe and Brinsley Schwartz were playing in their boarding school. Together, they had bands.
They had some band that had, I think it had Kipling in the name before they were.
Yeah, Kippington Lodge.
Okay.
That was sort of a precursor there to the Brinsley Schwartz Band because Bob Andrews joined that band, I believe. Now I know the history a lot more. And it was Nick and Brinsley and Bob Andrews, who was already a skilled musician when he was quite young, was going out playing military bases in Germany, which is a lot of those guys did that then. They joined bands like bands that could do like jukebox bands, you know, human jukebox stuff. And they did a lot of dance, soul and R&B. So they had such a wide range of experience that when they heard my songs, they heard what they knew. They knew that this was the styles that they had sort of been familiar with. But suddenly it's dressed up in this totally new way by me, a different way. And I was kind of naive to it. So I think that helped me a lot. Being naive to all of this helped me just, I wrote this, I felt like I was inventing chords and inventing everything. And really, there was a precedent for everything. You know, there always is.
Right.
But to me at the time, it felt like, holy man, I'm onto something here. But I, at the same time, I knew the influences, you know, from Van Morrison to the Rolling Stones to, you know, soul music, R&B, pop harmonies, you know, Between You and Me, bop, this kind of stuff. It's all in that realm. And I found myself uniquely placed that I could write in all these styles to some extent. And, you know, from Don't Ask Me Questions to Between You and Me to Lady Doctor, you've got three different ranges, totally different ranges there. They all fit together because it's me singing. And, you know, the rumor fitted them all together. And that was such a thing. They had a lot of trouble trying to figure out what to play because I did some unusual things that weren't the same as anything else.
Oh, like what? What do you mean?
Well, my rhythmic structure is a little bit different. It's familiar, but it's a little different. It's got its own sort of way to it, I think. And when I hear bands try to do Soul Shoes or any of my songs, they don't quite get the swing. They don't get the integral swing that actually comes from people like Jerry Lewis and Chuck Berry. There's an internal swing in my music, and the rumor got it. You know, it makes things a bit different from people even now that my name pops up with, that I'm compared with. I don't think they've got the same integral swing in the way. That's how I write songs. I've had a few people who've heard me and said, "You're all about rhythm, aren't you?" I said, I think I am in some respect. It's all about an internal swing in the rhythm.
Right. It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
Yeah, there I am quoting, you know, a jazz, what was that, Duke Ellington or something? Don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. Do what? Yeah, there I was even stealing that for Silly Thing, the song Silly Thing. There was nothing quite like it at the time with that kind of swing. And those kind of influences. So, you know, Howling Wind has a special thing. And it's not like I look back on it and think, God, it's out of date. It's old fashioned. I mean, it's obviously of its time. My singing is crude. You know, the rumor got more sophisticated as we went along. And when we reformed again, everyone was more sophisticated. We made Three Chords Good and Mystery Glue, our revival albums, you know, reunion albums.
Yeah.
In recent years, 2012 or something around that time. So it's, you change the way you play changes, but I still think we still have that internal swing between us. That's evident.
I want to interrupt for a second because I don't want us to leave out Dave Edmunds, because you mentioned playing Dave in the 90s, but he's also playing on Howlin' Wind. He's playing on Back to School Days.
Yeah.
So you weren't familiar with the guys in Brinsley Schwartz. Were you familiar with Dave Edmunds when he comes into the studio?
Yes, I was, because I hear you knocking. His version, I think, is a Smiley Lewis song, which I never, ever heard. I didn't know Smiley Lewis either. His version of that, which was a hit, a big hit in England, I'd heard it many times. And talk about unique kind of swing. Funky as all hell. What a single. What a single that is. If you haven't heard I Hear You Knocking by Dave Edmunds, anybody listening, listen to it. And he did other songs like, he did a Supreme song as well and made that a hit. He did cover versions, and he's guitaring. So he wasn't someone I followed. I didn't have any records by him, but I knew he was the business, you know. And the thing is, I think the Brinsley Schwartz band, they'd been involved with him. I think they backed him, and they worked in Rockfield Studios where he worked. He practically lived there. He was more of a recording artist than a live guy. But, you know, he did do a share of that, I think. But he was into the art of recording records and Rockfield Studios in Wales. He's a Welsh guy. And he was like ensconced there, from what I know. And I worked there. I did my second album, Heat Treatment, there. So Dave was brought in because I think Dave Robinson probably thought,
Or maybe, you know, Nick Lowe, I can't remember, but
Nick Lowe had worked with him. So then, and then Nick Lowe and Dave had re-met again, or they got together. They'd known each other before. A bit after I'd sort of happened, they became Rockpile. So all this stuff kicked off after me. It was pretty amazing to see. And then Dave and Jake Riviera, who'd already started a record company but had no acts. I sort of appeared and I became a bit pivotal, honestly, because Dave suddenly had a few bucks from, you know, commission from me.
Right. That's what I meant with him starting up Stiff Records right after.
And his dream, he always talked about it from the first gigs when I was in the back of the bus with the Rumour and Dave was there. After a few beers, he's going on about the record label he wants to form. Yeah. This was his dream. It wasn't me. You know, I was an unwitting instrument, but he was my unwitting instrument as well.
Exactly.
because you use each other, not even really thinking about it. It's just how things evolve, you know.
Well, I want us to talk about the title track for a moment, the Howlin' Wind, because I'm listening to the lyrics, and I feel like this. There's a howling wind blowing through us, right? This energy from the music, the passion of music, rock and roll. Typically, I read descriptions about the song saying it's anti-religion. Maybe that's because of the line with the preacher sparing the rod. How do you define your howling wind?
I think it's more about LSD than anything, frankly, to be really honest. But now, when I think about it, I think it's about where you restart your entire life from a different place. It's a reinvention, and what youth does is reinvent constantly. You know, young people, if they don't, they're conformists.
Oh, I see, yeah.
But even conformists, I know some people who are genuine conformists. They didn't drop far from the tree, who grew up in the suburbs.
Right.
Even they grew their hair long when it became a fashion, but they still were conformists. And I think in Guernsey, I became a nonconformist in a hurry, like all the other people I was meeting and hanging out with. And it sort of describes a rebirth, Howling Wind. And it's not anti-religion per se. It's more like a defiant. What is inside me is more than dogma. You know, because in Britain we were brought up with, we had one of our lessons in school was RI, religious instruction. You know, we were taught Bible, you know, classes in school. Sort of the Good Samaritan featured a lot.
Yeah.
No, nobody mentioned the Good Samaritan wasn't actually a Christian when he did the good things. They didn't tell you that. It's like, no, I'm sorry, you don't have to be a Christian. You don't have to have Mr. Jesus to do good things and be a decent person and have a moral fiber. You know, you don't have to. So Howling Wind's like that. It's a strange religion. We don't have any God. The preacher walks within us and spares the rod. It's not about punishment. There's no brimstone and hell. You know, there's none of these awful threats that they throw at you. So I think the song is defiant in that way. It's saying, you know, we're individuals and we work collectively for good things.
Is the wind still howling?
I'm 75. Are you kidding me?
You're still making music.
I'm still making music. Yeah, I feel it. You know, on stage, I was just playing in the States doing solo. And actually somebody said, I've seen Graham Parker a lot of times. And this was the most on fire I've seen him. So I guess something's still howling a little bit. But, you know, you temper it with many years of experience. And I can sing slower songs now without screaming them. If I scream them, I'd lose my voice. And, you know, you have to... You don't want to let people down by losing your voice on a tour like I used to constantly. And I never cancelled gigs. I don't think maybe one got cancelled because I couldn't speak. But I often couldn't speak before a gig and went on stage and made some awful banshee wail. And people loved it because I was walking around, strutting around, poking my finger in the sky. Hey, Lord, you know. And it was frenzy. You know, we had that kind of frenzy in the audience by the time we got to 78 and 79, even 77. So it was quite brilliant. But yeah, Howling Wind, I thought it was a good title track because of that. You know, it's that rejuvenation idea of things. And it's all inside you. It's not somebody's to enforce on you, dogma. In that kind of sense.
Well, the album closes with Don't Ask Me No Questions, and I just feel like, you know, we live in another pertinent time for a tune like that. That opening line, Crimson Autograph, is what we leave behind everywhere man set foot. Now, when did that line come to you, and did the song quickly followed after that?
Yeah, I don't know how it worked. Most of my songs are a combination of messing around on guitar, finding a slightly different way to do what is basically the same old pop tricks, really. I find a slightly different way, a slightly different angle for where the vocals come in. And what sounded ordinary suddenly does not sound ordinary, because I found a different kind of approach to dropping the melody on the chords. That was not a reggae groove song. The guy Noel Brown, who I met, who introduced me to a guy named Paul Bassman Riley, who was in a band called Chili Willy and the Red Hot Peppers, another alleged pub rock band. It was Noel Brown who said, "Oh, you should play that reggae." Because, you know, Howling Wind was a reggae groove. And so it was second nature to me. We grew up with ska music as well as soul music, right? It was second nature, reggae, because it was in the charts in England and there was all these great acts, the Scandalites and what have you, Prince Buster and the All-Stars. And then Bob Marley reinvented himself with the Wailers a few years before my career began. So it wasn't a stretch for me to suddenly turn, and it worked so brilliantly. It's like, oh, great. And that's how The Rumour learned the song, as a reggae groove. And I put this kind of funeral march at the beginning of it, that slowed down bit. So it all worked together, the lyrics with the song, with the structure. And it just came out, that line came out, Crimson Autograph, you know. And it's always true. It will never go out of date. In fact, I've been doing a song on this tour from 1991 from the Human Soul album on the tour in America. When I think I'll do it in England as well, upcoming tour in September. So it's a line from a song called Slash and Burn. And the last line is, criminals were elected to divide the world, for every head a bullet, for every swine a pearl. That held up well, and that's from 1991.
Especially well.
It's really, really well. Even more well than Crimson Autograph is what we leave behind, everywhere man set foot. But yeah, that will always hold up as well. It sounded good and it sounded true to me, and there it was on Howling Wind for people to hear.
Well, let me ask you this. We've been talking about an hour. I've got some more questions. How are you feeling? Are you okay to talk a little bit longer? Or
let's see. Oh, I've got to actually leave in about 15 minutes, because I've got to. I'm sorry. It's I've been in America for 4 months, and it's high time that me and Brinsley Schwartz and Martin Belmont met up for an Indian meal. You see.
Oh, that is perfect. That's a perfect escape thing. I wanted to ask you about with the song we're going to go out with. But you mentioned having this tour coming up, and I want to point out a tour in September in the UK. I want to point out that your latest album came out this past June on Big Stir Records, Quality Footwear, live at the Brook. That was recorded back in 2023. And on that record, you're joined by Martin Belmont as part of the backing band, the Gold Tops, about Belmont in The Rumour. Your last studio album, that was also on a Big Stir, called Last Chance to Learn the Twist. That came out in 2023. When can we expect a new album?
I'm always working inside on my head. Yeah, those were banned. The Quality Footwear album that is out now, I'll be bringing vinyl on tour. Actually, it's just getting no CDs. It was vinyl. Last Chance to Learn the Twist, CDs and vinyl. But Yeah, that tour was about, this is a solo tour, which is basically called 50 Years of Me. And I did it in the States recently. And so there's featured, half a century, we're talking Howling Wind, Heat Treatment, both came out in 1976. And I'm doing songs that relate to that quite a bit, and other songs like a bit off track there, like, as I said, Slash and Burn, where the criminals were elected to divide the world. So there's all that going on. A new album, well, I'm not in a hurry anymore, let's put it that way. I suppose I should look at my age and say, oh, you better get a move on and make another album. You've only made 26, you lazy bastard. Don't be such a lazy boy. Only 26 studio albums, you know. I'm always writing. I was just working on a song the other day. I'm just not in a sort of, it's not the most urgent thing in the world.
Well, sure. But tell me, can you tell us about the song you're working on? What's the inspiration? What's the kind of the gist of it?
It won't be giving too much away, really.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, but if I said the title, I suppose it would be, giving. It's so early days. I'm nowhere near getting a whole collection of songs that I'm completely happy with. I need to get the touring out of the way. In the old days, I could write albums between tours because I was young and my brain worked. You know, but now that doesn't happen. I write bits and pieces. I'm always scribbling down bits, and I always run to the iPhone in the middle of the night and wake up and go, play something on guitar and sing it, and then go back to bed naked. It's not a pretty sight, trust me. It's like 3 or 4 in the morning. I'm still doing that. It's disgusting. I'm still a bit of a slave to it, but. Yeah, so I need to stop the touring thing and say, okay, am I going to write these songs, finish them, and make an album or what? You know? So I will get to that. But the song, that I'm writing has a reggae groove, quite frankly. It's got a reggae groove going for it because that pops up from album after album. The last album, Last Chance to Learn the Twist, had a song called Them Bugs On, which has a funky reggae groove going on. So that's always been there from, album one, poaching from the Jamaicans, as it were, poaching from the Black America with our R&B and soul. It keeps going on, I guess. So that's,
yeah, but I mean, poaching, true, but you're still, I mean, you are, it still gets filtered through your own perspective.
Yeah,
and I think that's incredible. And in fact, they're definitely like on the Howlin' Wind. There's definitely, you can pick up, there's influence not only of the soul music, reggae music, rockabilly things with the Dave Edmunds song, but there's also, you can hear your songwriting similarities to like Van Morrison, and as you mentioned earlier, Bob Dylan as well. Speaking of Morrison, have you ever played a show with Van Morrison or met Van Morrison?
I've met him a few times, actually. The last time I was opening for Bob Dylan I think it was 1991, was it? Yeah, before I made the album Human Soul, I think. I was solo, and I did a tour with Dylan in Europe and the UK, and Van came to a gig in Belfast. As you can imagine, the Belfast cowboy, and he sat in with Bob. And that was the last time. I'd met him a few times before that. I think he was very wary of me. In fact, according to Dave Robinson, going back a bit now, Dave said that Van had called him and said, I want to be the producer of Graham Parker's next album.
All right.
Right?
Yeah.
And it was... And me and Dave looked at each other and we said, no. I don't trust a genius to be involved with making an album. But when I met him the last time in 91, he was very friendly to me. I think he'd had a few glasses of red wine. He was like, you sure? No, yeah. Oh, it's good out there. Keep up the good work, Graham. Suddenly he was very friendly and nice to me.
Oh, that's great. I was going to say, I saw him perform last year. It was his 80th birthday, sort of week of celebrations. And so I hadn't seen him perform before. And on stage, we had a great band, and they were great. But anytime anybody would be taking a solo, he would spin around with his back to the audience, and he's facing the musician. And I can't remember whether it's right hand or his left hand, but he's counting the bars out, you know, and his focus is right on him. And then right when it was back into the song, I mean, he'd twirl around, be right on the mic. His voice was still great. But I just thought, wow, that is so intense, man. If you were in the band working with him, I can't, you know, if he was your producer and stuff, that would be some, it'd be great. In many ways, it could be great, you know, but it'd also be really intense.
I must ask Dave about that again, because it was, you know, it was between Howling Wind and Heat Treatment. So obviously we didn't go with Van. We went with Dave Mutt Langer or whatever, Robert Mutt Langer, you know, the guy who went on to do Shania Twain and Def Leppard and stuff like that. But not, yeah, we didn't go with Van, but I got to ask Dave about that. I got to say, Dave, you told me this. I remember that Van had called up. I've got to look into this and get more detail from Dave if he remembers it. He's a bit older than me. Maybe he won't remember. But I remember it distinctly. It was so weird. But, you know, Dave Edmunds, as we were talking, played on my first album. And I kind of expected people like that to be kind of drawn to me. I expected good musicians and to be sort of like this. They knew what I was doing. They knew I was good. I thought that respect would sort of come here. Even before I'd made my first album. Once I'd written those songs, I thought nobody's going to stop this. Nobody's going to deny it. It's that good. So, you know, going back to that stage, I mean, I was sort of up my own ass for my own, you know, brilliance. But if you're not like that, you know, it's a bit of a cut. It's not an easy world to live in. I mean, I needed some drive, because I could easily be a shy guy as well. I could easily be like, I don't talk much. I stay out of the way. I'm kind of moody, you know. I could easily be that guy. There's a lot of different versions of me. And one of them was, I own the fucking room, you know. Excuse my friend. I own this room, okay. I'm the one. I'm the bee's knees. So that guy had to come forward. That guy had to get my career going. I had to be, and the songs, they talked to me. They said, you're that guy, be that guy, you know, don't waver. And even though inside I was nervous, yeah.
We're going to take a listen to another track off of Howlin' Wind. We're going to hear Nothing's Going to Pull Us Apart. That's the title as it is on the album, although you sing in the song, Nothing's Going to Pull It Apart. The lyrics there have the line, you got the will of iron and a heart of fire. You might try and stop the world and catch your soul's desire. Now, that lyric in there in the book, in Jay's book, Graham Parker's Howlin' Wind, he quotes you as describing that lyric, stop the world, as being sneaky. What is sneaky about it?
Well, it was from there was a guy named, I think it was a fake name. He turned out to be a fake writer. Carlos Castaneda or something. And he wrote these books about going to Mexico and doing magic mushrooms in Mexico and mescaline.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be all fiction, but it was brilliant. And all the heads like me had to read it, required reading. And I think it was either in that first book of his or one of the follow-ups. I think he wrote a few. The Teachings of Don Juan, A Yaqui Way of Knowledge. That was the title of his first book. It was a bit of a hit in its own way. And one of the things that Don Juan, the alleged teacher, had said to him, you know, with psychedelics and stuff and going into these frames of mind, Don Juan could stop the world, literally stop it from moving in time. Which sounds like a pile of psychedelic influence when everything stops dead and you're actually here now, exactly here and now, not in the past, not thinking about going to an Indian meal with your mates, with your bandmates. You're right here in this exact point of time and everything stops. I think he was talking about that. And so I said, you might try to stop the world and catch your soul's desire. So, you know, I was using a bit of that in the book. The book, again, is another song about reinvention and strength, with, you know, inner strength. reinventing yourself again. Quite inspiring. A lot of that period was for me, and it came out in these songs that people think are just sort of pub rock. Yeah, they had lots of drank beers and wrote songs. No, I don't think so.
No, not at all. Graham, thank you so much for talking with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Well, Mighty Manfred. Man. Okay, buddy. Thank you. Hi to little Stephen. Sorry, Steve Van Zandt. People change their names, don't they, as they get older? Anyway, hi to everybody, and thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. And Jay Nachman's Graham Parker's Howling Wind. Thank you, Jay.
That's right. Thanks to Jay as well. It's time for more Graham Parker. Here's Nothing's Going to Pull Us Apart off Howlin' Wind in Little Steven's Underground Garage. That was Graham Parker and The Rumor with a tad of Nothing's Going to Pull Us Apart here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. The track is from the debut album Howlin' Wind, celebrating its 50-year anniversary and subject of the recent book Graham Parker's Howlin' Wind by Jay Nachman. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Graham for speaking with me today on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Kurt Baker for producing our podcast. Oslo, Norway's all-gal band The Cocktail Slitters have got a new album out on Wicked Cool Records titled Joyride. We're going to find out all about it next time around when I'm joined by their bass player, Astrid Waller, also known as Sugarcane. She's my guest for our next Coolest Conversations presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Buddy, you're a boy. Make a big noise playing in the street. I'm gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace. Kicking your can all over the place.
Some things are better when they rock. The Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos rock around the clock with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pools, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Seminole Hard Rock Hotel and Casino in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida. We will rock you.